Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Liam, how are you, mate?
Not too bad tonight. Yeah, getting exhausted. End of the year, wrapping everything up.
Yeah, wrapping up. Yeah. That's a good... a good pun for this time of year. We're just at the start of December.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, wrapping's not one of my skills, so it's not a good skill of mine.
Oh man, me neither. Well, I mean, wrapping as in wrapping presents.
Oh, either. All definitions of the verb.
Yeah, I can't claim to not do that. What with there being a video online of me wrapping at NDC.
Oh, that's right. Forgot about that. Actually, speaking of NDC, I saw today too. I was going to ask you. They've got the pre-release early bird tickets on sale for next year.
Yeah.
You going at this stage?
Unfortunately, I'm not, no. It is on a date that is inconvenient for me, given that my birthday is on the first day, Riley's birthday is on the second day.
You know what? I think we've spoken about this either on the podcast or in person.
Very possibly.
You did mention that.
Yeah.
That's right.
I got family coming from overseas as well. So
yeah,
I'll have to give that one a miss, which is a shame.
No, that'll be a good one. Oh, well, I'll fly the flag for us, wear our t-shirts.
Yeah.
Both. Probably only one, not both, right. But one.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so you're starting to get a bit exhausted, but you're not quite there yet.
I'm certainly feeling it.
Yeah, same. It's been a busy week. Yeah. But anyway, so you're wrapping up for the year and you've been this year, you can't really talk about it because obviously it's confidential client stuff, but you've been... Most of this year you've spent like modernizing a legacy application, right?
Modernizing, maintaining, keeping it head above water, all of the above, yeah. More so the maintenance and just making sure it's sort of BAU more so than modernizing.
But right. Yes. So but it is a legacy application, right?
It's a legacy platform, it's a legacy suite of applications. I originally worked on part of this project back in, I think it was 2011.
Yeah.
So I think you can classify it as legacy.
That was the dark ages.
Yeah. When I started on this contract, I went through the code base and I saw plenty of to-dos with my name against it. Yeah.
Right.
They were dated. My name was there and so were colleagues at the time.
Wow.
People that I know have long moved on.
That's funny because we've spoken on the episode before, write your code as if the person that's going to come and read it next is coming after you with an axe.
Yep.
And that was your take. And I said, I don't know if you remember what I said. I said, write it as if the person that's going to come and read this code next is you.
That's right. Now, look, to be fair, though, I'm not working on that piece of the project, that piece of the application suite. But yes, I did have a look through the repo and saw my name there.
Right. So that part's a SOCP, some other chap's problem.
Some chap's problem. Yeah. So where were we? Yes. So I am in the process of maintaining and keeping the lights on for a legacy platform.
So what I'm hearing here is that, you know, there's technical debt in this with your name against it. But and despite the fact that you've come back and you're working on this, you're not the one that's repaying that technical debt.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You're repaying someone else's technical debt.
Well, I'm paying back someone else's technical debt. But
yeah,
the term technical debt is a really spot on analogy.
Yeah.
Right. Because, you know, the basis of technical debt, it's like monetary debt, right?
Yeah.
You take on debt to get you out of a sticky situation or to leverage your current position to be able to get you ahead in life, right?
Yeah.
Or to buy something that you probably shouldn't be buying.
Right. Yeah.
Right. All reasons to be taking on debt. And we do the same thing with code. Yeah. We take shortcuts. We cut corners, we do proof of concepts that end up in production for 15 years. We do all sorts of things that we know we shouldn't be doing, but they end up in the code base, right?
Yeah.
And then you end up with, you stick a to-do next to it, and all of a sudden you come back 15 years later and your name's still got to-do, fix this when XYZ happens.
Yeah.
Right. So we take those shortcuts for good reason at the time. You know, no one's saying that we go out of our way deliberately to do bad things or the wrong thing, but we take those shortcuts because of time constraints, because something might not be up and running at that point in time. We may not have all the information we want. For whatever reason, we're taking shortcuts. Now, I'm going to sort of just caveat with that. This is one type of tech debt, right, we're talking about.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're familiar with Martin Fowler's technical debt quadrant.
I'm sure I've come across it in the past, but I can't recall it off the top of my head.
So it's two rows, two columns.
Yep.
Across the top, you've got reckless and prudent. And yep. Across the side, you've got deliberate and inadvertent.
Yep.
Right? So the idea being that there's an intersection between something that you've done intentionally, saying, well, I know I'm introducing technical debt here, but yep. I'm doing it for a reason, and that reason is justified by XYZ.
And that's when you end up with to-dos in the code. Saying,
that's when you end up with to-dos in the code, yep. And then there's inadvertent, which is when you don't know what you're doing and you make yep. a mistake. And then now there is, I'm sorry, and then there's the reckless and prudent. So reckless is, you know,
I'm just going to do this because I can. I'm just going to go cowboy style.
Yeah. So the idea being that there's a kind of good debt, which is the prudent and deliberate, right?
Yep.
And when it comes to monetary debt, there's so-called good debt and bad debt as well. Now, the thing is that that doesn't account for technical debt that can, I mean, technical debt occurs over time naturally anyway, right? As a form of entropy. So if you write code and you don't maintain it for 5 years, there will be vulnerabilities in that code that need to be patched, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And that ends up, I guess that's that discussion around legacy, right?
Yeah.
So, and I guess that could be somewhere where this idea of debt or the analogy of financial debt to technical debt kind of differs a bit.
Yeah.
Or perhaps not. Inflation.
Yeah.
Right. Inflation will, you know, if you've got money, cash sitting in your top drawer,
yeah,
it loses value over time to inflation.
Yeah, that's right. But how does that become debt?
Well, I guess it's not, but it's losing its value.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the bow I'm trying to draw.
Depreciates.
Right. The value of it depreciates.
Yeah.
And I guess much like the software asset depreciates too.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the term technical debt is clever, and it's clever because there are clearly parallels with monetary debt,
mm-hmm.
but mostly it's a really good psychological tool and visualization tool for product owners or non-hands-on people to understand that when engineers tell you that you have to do something a certain way, and if you don't, there'll be consequences, yep. it's not always easy for engineers to articulate what those consequences are. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, there are people like you and me whose job it is to articulate those things on their behalf. But just as a tool to help articulate that, I think technical debt is a very powerful term. And when you are saying to someone who's a product owner or someone who's holding purse strings that, okay, you can save some money here, you can save some time here, but it's going to cost you more in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good way of framing it, because when we say technical debt, that's really what we mean, right? It's not just, okay, you don't necessarily have to do this now, you can do it later. That's not technical debt. Technical debt is you can either do this now or do it later. If you choose to do it later, it's going to cost more, because technical debt accrues interest. And I think that's kind of the key point that's often missed.
Yes, I think that is often maybe not missed, but it's not highlighted as much.
Underrepresented.
It's underrepresented. And it's not just accruing debt, accruing interest, but it's accruing compound interest.
Yeah, yeah.
Much like a mortgage repayment, right? You miss a mortgage repayment, it's going to cost you more next month.
Yep, yeah.
And yeah, I think you're right there in the fact that it's not just a debt that it's not just a small debt you have to pay back. It is a debt that you need to pay interest on before you can pay it back. And the longer you leave it, the more expensive it becomes.
Yeah, agree. I mean, look, if you're in sprint planning, or not even in sprint planning, but if you're working on something and you say, okay, this really needs to be done, and you as a team decide, let's not do that this sprint, let's focus on the sprint goal, we're very close, let's put that on the backlog and we'll do it next sprint. That's not mm-hmm. really technical debt. It's technical debt when you say, well, if we do it next sprint instead of doing it right now, then we're going to have to do more, because what we're doing now will need to be refactored next sprint to accommodate that.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's not technical debt. Like, we put things on the backlog all the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you and I think we've said it so many times on this podcast, right? Stick it on the backlog.
Yeah, that's right. It's just, yeah.
It's there.
The mythical backlog.
That's right. But no, you're 100% right there, right? If something ends up on the backlog, that's there as a placeholder for, to be addressed down the track.
Yeah.
But it's not in the code base. Like technical debt is when it's in the code base to an extent, right? We could also, as you mentioned before, one form is by not modernizing your applications, you are accruing technical debt inadvertently.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking about what you said, and I think that still holds because that's in your code base, right? So, you know, we've used the term legacy. I should have counted the number of times we've said legacy so far in this, in this episode. But that's what happens is like it becomes legacy. You don't have to do anything for it to become legacy. It becomes legacy because time passes and vulnerabilities are discovered and then exploits are created and then platforms are no longer supported. So you can't, you know, even run it.
Yep.
You know,
well, and then you're on operating systems that are no longer supported because the platforms that you need and they're only supported by old operating systems. And
you know, just
don't ask me how I know these things.
No, of course, nothing you encounter in your life. Slight tangent. I absolutely love that story about there's this guy, I think it's in Poland, who's running a workshop, like a car garage on like on a C64. Have you seen that?
No.
I'll find a link. I'll put it. We can put it in the show notes. Fucking brilliant story. This guy's just got a C64 that runs his business. He's been, you know, running it for like 40 years or whatever, and it still works. Why change it?
Absolutely. Until it falls apart and you can't find a replacement C64. But you could get an emulator, I guess.
Actually, again, way off topic, there is a huge community of legacy machine modders and revivers, including 664s. But let's not go down that rabbit hole. Actually, one final touch point on that rabbit hole. Andrea, who spoke at AdaConf, when we were at BeerConf afterwards, which is what I'm calling it, I can't remember her husband's name. Did you chat to him?
I don't believe I did. I chatted to a few people, but I can't remember who.
I spoke to him a fair bit. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he's deep into this stuff, and he's an Amiga fan, so we kind of bonded over that a bit. But he's really into sort of old hardware and old Motorola 80060.
Assembly. I know this is a rabbit hole that we didn't start down, but have you seen those series on YouTube where they build up
computers? A language from first principles.
Yeah, like not just languages from first principles.
But by first principles, they start with like how to build a CPU and logic gates and everything.
Well, how to build a transistor and then how to build logic gates. And then, they get to addressing and memory buses and whatnot. And it's just phenomenal how you can build it up.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And look, if you go back to first principles, I'm sure you could rebuild a C64 using off-the-shelf components these days. Anyway,
first principle sounds like an interesting topic.
I think that's on the backlog.
Put it on the backlog.
No, I think it's already on there.
It's on the backlog, I know, yeah. Sorry, as you were.
As you were.
So legacy. So yeah, so technical debt, you don't even have to do anything. And, you know, you don't have to put it in the code. Things that are in the code will become technical debt over time.
100%. And so what does that actually mean, though, for, I guess, in the BAU space, right? You know, we're all in the enterprise space. And I say we all, I mean you and me, the collective we. We're in the enterprise space, and you know, we're building these applications. Some clients just generally don't have the budget to keep the maintenance going on their products.
Yeah.
Other clients have full dev teams and they're constantly maintaining their applications, right?
Yeah.
Now, but what does that actually mean? Say if I built a product for a client, I let it sit on the shelf. It's doing everything it's doing and it's working 100% for them. No issues. And, you know, as I do, I never put bugs in my system, as I'm sure you don't.
Of course not.
No, never. Right. And everything's working really well. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, there's a vulnerability comes out and then you get a call up from the client. They say, can you make sure we don't have this vulnerability in our application?
Yeah.
Right. Don't know if that's happened to you, but it's happened to me in the past.
Yeah. And, you know, like you said, we don't have bugs in our code, but I have certainly had clients call me and say, there's a feature in this code that I would like to be a different feature.
Yes. Yes. A feature we didn't ask for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And
that's a bonus. That was free. Yeah.
I guess the point of this is, right, you then bring up the repository that you haven't opened for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
You realize that you've got a brand new, you've had 2 or 3 machines in that time, or at least one extra new machine. So you have to make sure your dependencies are updated, but lo and behold, you're not running the same version of .NET or Node that the original one was.
Yeah.
right? So then you've got to update that. You've got to make sure you've got that backwards compatible, or you're running a dev image, and then you make sure you've got the correct versions of all the frameworks in there. And then you run it, and then you start the upgrade process. And then you've got to upgrade 3 or 4 major versions in one hit of yep. the frameworks. And I'm thinking, in this particular instance, I'm thinking of, say, something like Angular.
Yeah.
Right? Or even .NET. I've had recent issues, or relatively recent issues, with, say, Entity Framework.
Yeah.
And you're doing maintenance or migrations 2 or 3 or even more major versions.
Right? So I was on a team recently. In fact, it's the project that I've been speaking about the past few months, actually, and I've mentioned it a few times. The last major piece of work that I did, I don't know if anyone knows and if anyone's listening, but I've got a new job. So this was my last piece of work at my previous employer for this long-time client of mine that Liam has actually previously done some work for as well, that I've mm-hmm. mentioned a few times. So that piece of software, Liam, that you and I did a spec review for them for yeah. 5 years ago, it's still going. Like, you yeah. know, it's still being maintained. We're still working on it. They're still using it. It's still growing.
No, but they're still using the application that I would have built before that spec review too, I think that, you said. Anyway.
That application is actually being retired, and the current piece of work is to move all the features of that application yeah. into the other one. So they're consolidating yeah. them. So the last piece of work that the team and I did on that before I left was upgrading that major versions. So it was .NET Core 3.1
mm-hmm.
and Angular 9.
Yeah. I just opened up a brand new, because I haven't touched Angular for a fair few years now, and I just opened up a brand new Angular project.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I think it was, just to muck around. Yeah. I didn't realize, but they're up to 19.
Yeah. 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 So that's, you know, several major versions.
Yeah.
And .NET as well, obviously from Core 3.1 up to, I think we went to 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it actually all went it all went pretty smoothly.
Yeah. And well, what I was going to say was, maintaining, well, LTS versions, long-term support versions,
yeah,
is generally, you know, from one LTS to the next is generally a lot more seamless. I was going to say a lot of the time there's going to be breaking changes because it's a major version update, right? But it's relatively straightforward, and the major changes or any breaking changes are quite restricted or quite contained and relatively easy to work your way through. But it's it depends, and that I guess that's the happy path. But the thing is, when you start to compound that across major versions, going from one to the next is actually quite a difficult challenge.
Yeah,
and I guess this goes back to that whole point you were talking about the your technical debt just accruing without you even being aware of it, right? And I mean it's one of those things that I've had the privilege of doing these upgrades in the past.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to jump ahead too far because there is a solution to that problem, which we'll come back to. Well, spoiler, it's TDD, right? That's how you solve that problem. Well, that's how you mitigate the risk of that problem.
You mitigate the risk, absolutely.
But sorry, what I was going to say was, you know, I've seen legacy systems. I mean, I've seen one particular system, which was an ancient timekeeping system, which was originally built as a SQL database.
Oh, yeah.
And then was, I think, later updated to ASP, literally mm-hmm. just ASP, right? Not even .NET.
Well,
and then grew into, you know, ASP.NET, you know, using .NET framework, and just grew and grew and grew without any kind of architecture or planning or
mm-hmm.
Any of that kind of stuff. And it was quite the spaghetti. And there were some people that I know that were working on it, and it took years, like years, to upgrade this thing. And I think they're still going. And there were so many problems to solve. And mm-hmm. of course, there weren't particularly useful tests, and certainly not many of them.
Yep.
So that meant that there was a lot of risk with this upgrade. And it mm-hmm. absolutely ruled out what you would really want to do in that situation, which is just greenfield, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like normally when you come to that. Yeah. Normally So rewrite, rebuild, refactor. That's the big question, right? Is when do you do it?
Yep.
When do you not do it? Now, the answer to when do you not rebuild is when if you don't have tests, you can't.
Well,
I mean, of course you can, but like that's a major risk, right?
Not necessarily.
No.
Because I mean, a rebuild to me also implies you can offload features that were built in that you never needed. You can add features right? You're starting from, it's greenfield, like you said, right? You're starting from scratch.
Yes, but that assumes that you have good practices around, I mean, there's a lot of discipline required around doing it that way too, right? And that's making sure that you have good requirements established, mm-hmm. documented. You have good models of the domain, the problem domain and the solution domain. Your users have a, and your maintainers have a good understanding of the full scope of the system and what it's doing,
yep.
including mm-hmm. those routines that run in the background that nobody even remembers. But when they fail, shit hits the fan.
Oh, look, it's a scream test, right?
Yeah, that's right.
No, you're spot on there. So, I mean, yeah, and on that, right, speaking of analogies and, you know, tech debt being an analogy for financial debt, right, what I find in that space, what I find a useful way to talk to non-technical people or non-software technical people about this kind of thing, I use the analogy of buying a car.
Right.
Right. Okay. Up front, there's a big expense to buy your car. You yep. might spend anywhere, what, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $100,000, $200,000 on a car, right? Building that's enterprise cool. software is expensive up front.
Yeah.
But when you buy a car, you still need regular maintenance on that car.
Yeah.
Right. You need to go in. You need to get your petrol car these days. Not so much for the electrics, but it works better for the petrol cars. You need to get your oil change.
Yeah.
Quite regularly.
Yep.
Right. You need to pay for that maintenance. You need to pay for new brakes and you need to pay for your tires. You need to pay for the oil changes. You need to pay for your regular maintenance schedule, right?
Yep.
What happens if you don't?
Well, classic example, what's the one thing that you didn't mention is your timing belt.
Yeah, and your timing belt. What happens if you don't? The engine blows up, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like then, maybe that's the extreme example, but yeah.
It is. But then this is why I use that analogy with software maintenance and the car. Because a lot of people are familiar, and, you know, I just get my car serviced every 12 months.
Yeah.
Because I don't want it to blow up.
Yeah.
Because I know if it blows up, it's going to cost another $30,000 to replace the engine.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with software. You've got a massive upfront cost to build the software. And if you do not spend your ongoing maintenance, keeping it up to date, there's going to come a point in time where you're going to have to replace the engine.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very expensive.
Yeah.
And I find that analogy kind of helps people understand why, you know, because a lot of people will think, you know, it's software. You don't need to maintain it. Mm. You don't need to top up its fluids. You don't need to change its oil. It's software.
Yeah.
But you, like you mentioned earlier, vulnerabilities appear vulnerabilities are discovered in frameworks, in underlying frameworks and dependencies, right?
Yeah.
These things happen and we need to keep on top of it.
Yeah. That's right. There was a lot of interesting discussions at AdaConf, and there was a comment which I think was Chris Simon, and I'm sure I've heard him say this before. You know, where someone says it was around that point we raised earlier. Well, you know, the discussion: how do you make the decision? What's the framework? I mean, the whole topic of the whole conference was decision making frameworks, right? But one of the questions was, what is the framework for making a decision about whether to rebuild or refactor?
Yep.
And what Chris said is, well, if you're maintaining your software properly, you're continually refactoring. So there's never that decision, because there's never a need to rebuild.
And I think you'll find, if we go back to our original interview with Chris,
he said it.
He mentions it. He mentions it. Always be modernizing. Either he said it on that episode, or he mentioned it to us during our conversations. But
yeah,
I always remember him saying that.
The problem there, though, is that's an easy position to take for us, because we're aware of how it all works, right? But selling that to a CFO, that's the challenge. And I think what we need for that is case studies.
I can give you one right now.
Okay. Yep.
I was in a retro yesterday.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that was, you know, that didn't go well, or, you know, that were in the glum column.
Yeah.
Whereas we're starting to see a ramp up of production incidents, releases not going 100%, productivity down.
Yeah.
And there was quite a lot with that kind of theme. And I was sitting there and just looking at it, and you know, it kind of a little bit of a light bulb moment, but you know, we've been speaking about it and it's part of the team for a bit, but the light bulb moment in the retro was, well, they're different items, right? Production issues, release issues, whatever, or productivity, they're different. But if you take a step back, they're related to one thing.
Right.
Tech debt.
Yep.
A complicated code base that is difficult to maintain, difficult to update, and it takes a long time to get new features out.
Yep.
And we were talking about it, and then talking with the delivery manager, and she was saying, particularly around the lack of productivity, or the I shouldn't say lack of productivity, the reduction in productivity.
Velocity.
The velocity, correct. Thank you. Right. The reduction in velocity. And she was saying, well, we do generally account for 20% of tech debt time. And that was that sort of the case study moment, or that standout moment that's like, no, actually, our tech debt is so significant that 20% is not a sufficient estimate for the time that we're spending due to tech debt.
Yeah. And that's, yeah. Right. And that's where the analogy really holds well for compound interest, right?
Yeah, right. Early on, 20% is probably a reasonable value. And it's not just the simple fact that we're adding debt because we're taking on more of a mortgage, but it's also because we haven't paid any of it down. It's really accumulating now. And now we're getting to a point where actually we need to start considering our sprint budget. More than 20% of our sprint budget needs to be assigned to paying this down, because it is actually starting to impede our current productivity level.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, it's interesting.
If you want a case study, there it is. But
yeah, it's good. I mean, the reason that I bring that up and say we need case studies is, if you think about, well, actually, I've got a much better example, which I'll come to in a minute, but I'll do this one first. If you think about insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody looks at, well, look, I'm sure there are people that do, you know, look at it and say, I don't want to pay the insurance, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to spend the money elsewhere or save the money.
Yeah.
Or just can't afford it, right? But there's all kinds of like liability insurance, and there's all kind of other things that you legally cannot operate a business without, right? Yeah. But the point being that no one looks at insurance, you know, none of the CFOs or the purse string holders look at insurance and say, justify this. Why should I pay this? Why don't mm-hmm. we spend this money on this work that I want to get done instead of spending it on insurance? They just accept that that's part of the cost of doing business.
Yep.
But while I was saying that, I thought of a much better analogy. You were talking about enterprise software, and you're talking about software that you build, but even off-the-shelf software, right? As an enterprise software customer that you purchase from a vendor, yep. you don't buy that software without software maintenance. Now, things are changing, of course, because we've got SaaS and the cloud. Yeah. So those upfront costs are going away, and it's all becoming, you know, an OPEX rather than a CAPEX.
Yeah.
But in the traditional software model, people would buy software, and you would have annual maintenance that you would pay. And, mm-hmm. Maybe people did question it, but you don't really have the choice of not paying it, because if you don't pay it, then you don't get bug fixes. You don't get security patches.
Yep.
You certainly don't get any new features, but you may not care about that.
Mm-hmm.
But you pay your annual software maintenance, and it's usually charged at 10 to 20% of the license fee.
Yeah.
The license fee being the upfront purchase cost.
Yeah. I think that's pretty spot on, except that analogy is not as common these days.
No. And the other thing is that what we're talking about when we're talking specifically about tech debt is not 10 to 20% of the upfront cost of building the thing. We're talking about 10 to 20% of the ongoing work to deliver new features.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. And it's one of those things that absolutely we need to, I think, from a tech side of things, it's hard, because from an engineering perspective, we always want to do the best we can. And we always, you know, I'm always trying to fly the flag for reducing that tech debt. But at the same time, obviously the business side and the product side want new features.
Yeah.
And there's a balance. And also from an engineering perspective, if we're not adding new features, well, it's kind of quite boring too, just to
absolutely
to keep that.
Yeah.
Keep that up to date. So absolutely we want to, but it's hard. And
you said there's prudent tech debt, right? So you might make a decision. In fact, this is actually an example we've used on the podcast before. I'm pretty sure that we've used this example before, and it's made up, but it's based on true events, I guess. But like, let's say you are building your software product, and you make a decision, and you say, all right, we need to do it this way so that it will allow us to scale to 10 million customers, which is what our projected business is that we're going to grow to. Okay. How long is it going to take you to do that work? It's going to take 6 months. All right. if you don't do that work, how many can it scale to? Well, it can scale to 1,000. It's like, okay, well, don't do it. And it's like, well, but what if we scale? And, you know, what if we hit that limit? It's like, we've got zero customers now. Let's not worry about it. Let's just build it. And, you know, we'll keep an eye on it and we'll know that that's there and we'll monitor it. And if we get to 500 customers, then we'll say, all right, we know that we can double or no more because we can't scale. We need to invest 6 months at work. So, okay, you can do that. But then it's going to become 12 months of work. It's 6 months if we do it now, you know. Yeah, and that's the interest that accrues. But I mean, the point being that sometimes that is a decision that as a business you make, and it's the right decision. 100%. And sometimes that business will grow to 700 customers and quite happily chug along on 700 customers, and that technical debt will never come back to bite you.
Or you find optimizations along the way that can help you improve that scaling. And
yeah,
and you know, this is, I think,
buy more RAM.
Buy more RAM, exactly. Absolutely. Spin up a new instance, right? Add a new VPC. You're all good.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say. So one of the other things that we've spoken about in the past too, you know, is, and I think what you're talking, well, similar to what you're talking about there, is that proof of concept idea.
Yeah.
And we all know that proof of concept that you do.
Yeah.
That's meant to be the throwaway piece of code.
Yeah.
That ends up supporting the entire business for the next 10 years.
Yep. I mean, that's never happened to me, but I've heard people speak about it. Sure.
And I guess that's pretty much, that's along the lines of that reckless tech debt, right?
Yeah.
But that's not from the engineering perspective. That's not us saying, hey, we think this is good to go. Like, we're given all the red flags we can, saying, do not use this in production. But then the business side, the product side, turn around and say, no, it's all good. We're doing it. We're adding features. Then they get addicted to the velocity that you're adding new features at, and they just want more.
Yeah.
And then over time, like, I think the thing here is the accumulation of the tech debt, it's death by 1,000 cuts.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because sort of to carry on my analogy, right, the business are asking for features and you're throwing them in and they're getting that dopamine hit because they're getting as much features as quick as they want. They're asking for them, you're delivering them quicker than they can ask.
Yeah.
But then they start to slow down, but only by a little bit. Yeah. And no one really notices that drop in velocity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that keeps happening. And then before you know it, the velocity's plummeted, but no one has really noticed it drop.
Yeah.
Because it's happened slowly.
Yeah.
And that's
a shallow decline.
Exactly. And that's the situation I think that I have recently found our team in.
Yeah.
And I guess the question there is, how do we identify that before it becomes crippling?
Okay. So you're saying, what are the warning signs that you are working on the next legacy platform?
Pretty much. Or that you've been promising, or the business have been promising, or you've been promising the business way too much, or they've been addicted to asking for so many more.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Running at a sprinting ahead without actually stopping to catch their breath.
Yeah. And it's in a cartoon. You're running so fast that you go straight off the edge of the cliff and don't realize until you look down.
Yeah. Yeah. The old Roadrunner cartoons.
Yeah. I was laughing earlier just where you were telling that story because, you know, I'm working on it. The project I'm working on now is a POC. I literally put a comment today in something that said, do not deploy to production.
And sorry, how confident are you that that actually gets adhered to?
Pretty confident because it's a sample data seeder.
Fine.
But like in this case, yeah.
Until you jump onto their public website that's got sample data in it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, just back to that I could see you smiling when I said it, that question, what are the warning signs that you're working on the next legacy platform?
Yeah.
So if you, like, I'm sure you remember that was one of the questions. So there was back to AdaConf again, the panel discussion that we saw, which was, what was it? Rewrites, rebuilds, refactors, oh my.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah. It was a great panel discussion. One of the questions from the audience was, what are the warning signs that you're working on the next legacy platform?
Yep.
And the answer was, you are.
Yep. 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Today, we are writing tomorrow's legacy.
Yeah. I thought that was a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. But, and I think we just need to be aware of it.
It does dodge the question a little bit because what the question really means is, what are some red flags to watch out for that you are writing unmaintainable code? But really, that's kind of a very junior level question, I guess.
Yes.
Well, again, actually, no, sorry, I'm looking at it from the wrong perspective. That's from the engineering point of view, right? But again, like this scenario that you've just described, which is you do your POC or you do some quick hacky thing just to get something up and running for a demo. And then the product owner says, yep, ship it.
Yep.
And then you laugh and say, okay, so look, I'm going to go away and rewrite this. And he's like, I wasn't joking. I want to see this in prod tomorrow. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
that's the red flag.
Yeah, it is. But I guess the counterpoint to all this is, unless, professionally speaking, unless what we're doing is commercially viable, we don't have a job.
Yeah.
Open source aside, if we're not producing features that can sell, then there is no point for us to be writing the software. Right? If the business is not making money from the software,
yeah,
there is no point in actually spending money building the software. We could turn around and argued to no end saying we need to be paying down our tech debt and I just want to spend all this time without adding features. But there's going to come a point where the business is like, no, we need features because if we don't have the features, you don't have a job.
Yeah, that's true. You and I have both worked on projects like that where we as the engineers have even pushed that perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of one project where, you know, I inherited it and it was almost exclusively tech debt. I mean, that's not fair because it was a working product.
Mm-hmm.
It is still a working product. But the tech debt had compounded so much that the velocity had reached zero.
Yep.
And had stayed at zero for about 12 months by the time they came to us and said, this is, you know, what's going on here? And in fact, they'd kind of lost faith in the product altogether.
Just to clarify, this is the product. It's not that they came to you and said, you guys are running slow. You're running at velocity zero. What's going on? It's they came to you saying, our current vendor is running at velocity zero. Can you help us out?
Correct. Yeah. Our current partner. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. They didn't really. So the incumbent had not shared with them concepts like burn down, velocity, DevOps, Scrum,
yeah.
Anything like that. So they didn't phrase it in those terms, but they were frustrated that they didn't appear to be getting anything done. And it turned out that the other vendor was repaying tech debt. And, you know, what they were doing was legitimate. You know, it was they weren't, you know, it's not that they were taking their money and doing nothing with it. They were doing a lot of work and they were trying to repay a lot of technical debt. Where they went wrong, in my view, was by not being firmer with the client and saying, we need to stop actually what we're doing altogether and stop trying to do new features here. And we need to, and this isn't just paying down tech debt at this point. This is, we need to rebuild this. This is not going to work. That's a whole other discussion.
If you want to just quickly carry on the financial analogy.
Yeah.
That's basically saying, I'm going to take 100% of my take-home pay packet and put it against my mortgage.
Yeah.
And pay down my debt. Means I don't have anything for my living expenses. I don't have anything extra for holidays. I don't have anything extra for the nice stuff. I'm just taking all my money and paying down that tech debt.
Yeah. Now, obviously, that analogy, you know, that's not realistic in the real world, right?
No.
Except if it comes to the point where your interest rate is so high that you are accruing more debt than what you're paying down. Sometimes that is, in fact, what you actually have to do. We're straining the analogy. Where I was going with this was what I actually said to that client was, in any other scenario, under normal circumstances, I would say to you, your code base is not maintainable. You have so much technical debt here that before we can even think about giving you any new features, we absolutely have to either rebuild this whole thing or spend a lot of time and effort repaying this technical debt.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that you're going to spend a lot of money and you're going to see a lot of work being done, but you're not going to see any results. Now, normally that's what I would do. However, in this case, because you haven't had any velocity for over a year, in this case, I'm going to make an exception and I'm going to say, we're going to find a way to ship you at least one build with new features before we do that. But once we've done that, we are going to have to go and do that. And given the scenario where you've had another partner, who's been doing this, and it's very difficult for me to come along as the new guy and say, all right, you need to give me X amount of money and X number of months or years of work for me to not show you any results. It's just not realistic. So I'm going to find a way to ship you at least one build with at least one new feature and at least one bug fix, because I need to gain your confidence that when I then go away for several months and you don't see anything for all the money you're spending, you need to have faith that I'm doing the right thing.
So, I mean, I've got two takeaways from that. One is basically delivering value straight up front.
Yeah.
Right. To help build trust, but to help the client move forward, which goes back to what we were saying before, right? We can't just constantly focus on tech debt. We do need to realize that the business needs to actually make money from the product.
Yeah.
Right. But the second thing, and that was, you kind of said it, but you never really highlighted it, but just the simple fact of communicating with the client, setting expectations.
Yeah.
Letting them know what situation they're in.
Yeah.
What they can expect and how you can help them achieve that.
Yeah.
And that in itself is far more valuable than you delivering the features.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, it's like just straining the monetary debt analogy a bit more. Otherwise, it's like saying, okay, well, you've borrowed some money and you've been paying it back. I'm not going to tell you how much you still owe or, you know, what the interest rate is.
Or if you were to lose your job, I'm not going to tell the bank manager that I can't make my next payment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. No, you're going to call them up and say, look, I'm struggling at the moment. I'm on, can we just put our repayments on hold for the next month or so?
Yeah.
Right. In these situations, you cannot over communicate enough.
You arguably cannot over communicate.
Sorry. I added the word enough for no reason.
I'm just being a dick. That is how I roll.
Yeah.
No arguments.
No, it's no argument for me.
So, you wanted to talk about this because you said tech debt has been bugging you. So vent, let it out.
Well, no, I think it's not necessarily that it's been, well, it does bug me to no end, but it's top of mind because of the retro that I just mentioned before.
Right.
And it was that idea that the reduction in velocity snuck up on us.
Mm.
And it was only apparent in that retro, the impact that our tech debt was having on our reduction in velocity, our production issues, and issues with our releases.
Yep.
Right. Arguably three different things that are quite disparate that kind of had a common thread, but it wasn't an obvious thread.
Mm.
And I guess that's why it's top of mind for me right now. And it's just one of those things that it's more just a warning for all, right? Much like financial debt. It creeps up on you.
Yeah.
We know it's there. We know we have some amount of debt. We know we have payments to make. But sometimes you do not realize how much you actually have and what it's costing you.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So the question is, how do you make it visible? And sometimes we might add a comment to some code. And I'm a firm believer that any to-do in code should also include a link to the backlog item.
Yep.
So if I'm ever doing a code review or reviewing a pull request, if I see a to-do and that to-do is not accompanied by a link, the PBI or the backlog item or the issue that it references, I don't approve that.
Yep.
But even so you've put it on the backlog, there's a to-do in the code. How do you then stay on top of that? And how do you not just stay on top of it, but retain visibility of the total debt that you're accumulating? And how do you also stay on top of the impact, where that impact is occurring? Yeah, how do you look at that as a product owner and say, well, I can see that the engineers or the engineering team has logged all these issues. Even if you do a search every, you know, backlog refinement session where you say, okay, now let's filter by tech debt. Yep. And you look at all these tech debt items, you say, yeah, okay, so I can see that we've got 400 hours of estimated effort of tech debt. Okay, last month it was, you know, 350. So that's going up. That's not good. Sure. But like, how do you look at it and say, well, you know, looking at the milestones, so looking at the roadmap, you want to do this. Now, if you did this 6 months ago, when we said you should, you'd be on track. But now this milestone is going to have to move because it's going to take us longer to fix this
issue.
And
that's the hard thing, right? Because as you said, you could, in your refinement sessions, you can look and say, we have 300 hours worth of tech debt to repay. That's our outstanding balance. Yep. That is not... That does not, by no means, take into account the impact that that debt has on your velocity.
Yep, that's right.
And that is the critical thing. And I think, and this
and
is
that's
where
what you just experienced. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And we're aware that the tech debt's there and we're aware at a high level of what impact it has, but you're unaware of the impact on velocity. Now, I think part of the reason why this is so difficult to identify is an increase or a reduction in your team's velocity can be attributed to two things, right?
Yep.
One, an increase in productivity or a decrease in productivity.
Right.
Two, better or worse estimates.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Now, when your velocity goes down,
yeah,
what's the instinct to say is the reason why it's gone down?
Yeah, we need to refine our estimates.
Exactly. Yeah. Spot on.
Yeah, you're right.
We always, because it's easy to blame estimates, because estimating is difficult.
Yep.
So it's easy to blame your estimates. And
yeah,
honestly, I've only just come to this realization in the last 10 seconds whilst I've been talking to you about this.
Yeah.
But perhaps a lot of the time we see variance in our velocity that we attribute to poor estimates. Maybe we need to take a step back and see if there is any contribution to our tech debt to that variance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good call. Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Not saying that estimates will get any better. I'm not saying that they're accurate.
I actually think estimates can get a lot better, but that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I guess my point there is we can't remove any of the blame from estimates, but I think there is not enough attribution to tech debt.
No, I think you're right. Yep, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a whole conversation that bears exploring on its own. We need a methodology, basically. We need to, there's an opportunity there for you, Liam, to define a new methodology, write a book, do a talk. Save us all from tech debt.
And by me, you mean we?
Sure.
Oh, no, look, I guess, so to wrap it all up, right? You know, we've spoken quite a lot about, and I'm trying to figure out if we can segue this. We've spoken quite a lot in the past about DDD, right?
Yeah.
And how it can help us in the enterprise space. Now, part of the whole idea of DDD concepts is it's an ever-evolving model.
Yeah.
That we're growing as we understand our domain better, we grow our model.
Yep.
The bounded context that we start with on day one are not necessarily the bounded context that we have 2 years down the track.
Yep.
Because we understand the model better.
Yep.
And it's that constant refactoring of the model and the code bases alongside each other that help keep our code in a way that is consistent with the business and the domain.
Yeah.
This is not taking into account the technical implementation details that we've had to cut corners for down the track, but I think it's all part of it.
Well, I mean, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought again. There you go.
But I was just going to say, and sort of to your point about frameworks and workshops and whatnot for looking at this kind of stuff, maybe it's something that we could add and we could focus on or identify and work on for this workshop that you and I are talking about.
That's a great idea.
And for those that know me and those that have interacted with me, this is kind of how my brain works. I'll spitball ideas and just come up with ideas and just blurt them out.
So yeah.
It's not something I've thought about in the past, like adding that level to that kind of workshop, but I think the maintenance of your model and the maintenance of your product is absolutely a worthwhile aspect of that workshop that you and I are going to work on in 2025.
I do agree. I'm not sure 100% if the context and the scope is right for that particular thing, but we can figure that out. But certainly in terms of maintaining the model, I mean, the thing is, a model by its very nature is incomplete.
Yep.
Right. By definition, a model cannot be complete, because the only 100% accurate representative model of a thing is the thing.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people miss that.
Hmm.
And they try to have a 100% accurate representation.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Absolutely. That's a whole nother topic.
It is a whole nother topic. But the point being that it's not just that your understanding of the model grows over time. It's that the parts of the thing that the model models may grow or evolve over time.
Absolutely.
Or become refined.
And again, if you look at if you go through the blue book, right, one of the first examples he shows in the the circuit diagramming or the circuit modeling domain that he was talking about.
Mm.
The first feature that they were looking at and building, which was apparently mission critical, once they get through and start figuring it out and working through the domain, they realize that it's not required.
Yeah. That's never happened to me.
No, never. Never at all. But that, I mean, that's spot on the point that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we understand of that model right now is valid, but it doesn't mean it is tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Who knew so much could be said about tech debt?
Tech bankers. I don't know. Actually, it's amazing that someone hasn't capitalized on that and there aren't people getting rich off tech debt.
Oh, there are.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Because with monetary debt, there are literally companies that will buy bad debt, right? It's like they'll come to you and say, this person owes you, you know, $100, but right now you're getting nothing from them. We'll give you $80. Well, it's actually probably a lot less. It's like, we'll give you $20. It's like, well, they owe me $100. It's like, well, you can have $100 owed to you, or you can have $20 that you actually have.
Yeah.
And we'll take the risk.
And then they chase the risk. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get whatever we can out of them. Sometimes it will be nothing. Sometimes it will be more. But yeah, I'm surprised someone hasn't figured out a way to exploit. And I do use the word exploit because it, you know, there's no way to do it in a way that's ethical or meaningful. It would just be exploitation. But I'm surprised someone hasn't done it because people find a way to exploit anything.
People do. But an interesting concept. I wonder if there is a way to. And again, I don't like that word. I get your use of the word exploit.
Yeah.
But I don't want to work on that. But I wonder if there is a way that
leverage.
You could leverage the tech debt, right? And look, this is a conversation I've had with my current client quite often, right?
Yeah.
And it's quite the opposite to exploiting. And it's basically, if I'm not adding value, I don't need to be here.
Yeah.
Right. And I only want to be in places where I'm adding value. Right? I don't need to be doing something just to send an invoice. I want to make sure that I'm actually adding value to the customers that I'm working with.
Yeah.
And if we think about it that way, is there a way that you could add value to a system focusing on that tech debt? But I mean, the obvious answer is, well, yes, you just focus on paying down tech debt, but there's got to be another way.
This is a whole other conversation, like I said, but one approach might be to treat it like a credit system, right? So when you're doing your sprint planning, instead of just putting things on the backlog and deciding, you know, well, this sprint, we're going to do 20% tech debt, blah, 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 blah. When you pay your mortgage, right, the proportion that you pay that's interest versus the proportion that's principal is inversely proportional to the amount that you owe. So when you owe a lot, you're paying interest mostly and you pay a little bit of principal.
Yes.
The less you owe, the more principal you're paying, the less interest.
Yes.
We could treat it the same way.
I like that. I like that. I was going to say, except that it's a lot harder to quantify tech debt, but if as engineers, we actually document it in our backlog correctly,
which we should be doing,
then I guess that's a good way to actually look at it. Because I often, you know, you've been in the discussions where it's like, we need to pay down tech debt. And then you've got the business side saying we need new features. Someone's going to make the decision. The product owner has to make the decision. Where are we spending that money? And, you know, again, as an engineer, I like a straight up algorithm that I can apply.
Yeah.
Instead of just having this airy fairy, oh, we've got too much tech debt, so we need to pay some down now, or I think we're doing all right.
Yeah.
Like there's a heuristic there that you can just apply straight away. The more there is, the more we need to pay down.
Yeah.
If you think about it, and it's just bloody obvious.
Well, yes, that's true. And there's an existing formula for working that out, right? It's what the banks use for figuring out how much of your repayment every month on your mortgage goes to them and how much goes to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I don't know about you, but it's a bit too late at night for me to be doing those kind of equations right now.
It's not only too late, but I think I've had one too many beers.
I think I've had one too few.
What have you been drinking?
G&T this evening.
Ah, it's better than water.
It is better than water. But I've got this problem, right? And my problem is that...
Alcohol?
My problem is that I don't know how much alcohol I've got. So I've got two kegs in the kegerator.
Yep.
One of them is pretty much full, but it's not fully fermented. So I need to fix it.
Yeah, you keep talking about it.
And I haven't done it yet.
Come on.
Because it's too hot. The reason that batch needs to be rescued was because I tried to, it's a lager and it was just too hot for the lager yeast. And if I try and do it now, it's just going to die. I've just got to wait for a day where it's cool enough for me to just take that out of the kegerator and like rack it off to the fermenter, and just enough for me to just do that and get the yeast in without it dying.
So you have two solutions to that problem.
What's that?
Two solutions to that.
Right.
One, get yourself a fermentation fridge.
I'll come back to that one. But yeah, what's the second one?
You should have done it over winter.
I should have done lots of things over winter. Yes.
But that's not really a solution. So
no.
Or you can wait till next winter.
Well, here's the problem, right? I'll have that fermentation fridge discussion with you another time. But in terms of my immediate problem, right, and the reason I'm drinking G&T and not beer, back to your original question, I've got the keg full of lager, mm-hmm. right? I don't know whether that's going to be rescuable, even if I do find the time to do it. I've got another keg that's got what turned out to be a bloody good pale ale in it.
Yep.
I don't know how much is in there.
That's the problem with kegs.
Yes, and that's also a problem that I've tried to solve, and that is a whole another episode. But we've got, I think now, 16 or 18 people coming for Christmas.
Mm.
And I just don't want to drink any of the beer, basically. I want to make sure that there's at least some beers on tap for when people show up on Christmas Day. So that's why I'm drinking the G&T today.
Fair enough. I've gone through, I've just had a big glass of the Australian Pale Ale that I brewed recently. So last couple of episodes, I was drinking the Stout.
Yeah.
This one's the Australian Pale Ale, which is really nice.
Yeah.
Probably do that one again.
Is that what I would call a clone and wood? That's what I've got in my kegerator, by the way.
Yeah. Don't know. I'd have to have a stone and wood on hand to be able to compare. But no.
I don't do that. It just makes me feel very bad about myself.
No. This was, again, like the stout, this was a recipe from the recipe card at Hop and Grain up at Marrickville. I just walked in, picked up the recipe card and said, yep, that looks good.
Yeah.
Because I just couldn't be bothered thinking about it. But I wanted to be able to just walk out of the shop with enough grain to be able to do a good brew.
Yeah.
And it turned out good.
Okay. Yeah, nice. So I'll just retract my comment about Stone & Wood. So Stone & Wood is a great beer. And the beer that
I do enjoy Stone & Wood.
Yeah. And the beer that I make is by no means as good as Stone & Wood, but it's, you know, it's, I would say it's respectable.
Yeah.
But I would 100% say do not drink a Lord Nelson Three Sheets without a buffer of like a week before or after you drink one of your homebrews, because it will just make you feel very bad about yourself.
I'm just trying to process that statement.
If I have a Lord Nelson Three Sheets,
yeah,
right? If I don't give myself a window of at least a week and then I have one of my beers, it just seems shit by comparison.
Yeah.
I drink one of my beers, and if I don't have at least a week buffer before drinking a Lord Nelson Three Sheets,
yeah.
It makes me think my beer is shit.
Look, I do rate the Three Sheets. I don't know if I'd rate it. I'm just trying to think, how do I word this? Because I don't want to sound like I rate my beers remarkably high, but because by no means, right, even these ones have faults to them, but they're still drinkable. But yeah, I don't know, I don't really compare them.
Well, you know what they say, comparison is the thief of joy.
Yes, they do. Who are they?
They being me. I say that. No, that's a proverb.
Oh, look, no, I get it. But I don't know. I would look at it not as a comparison as how good does mine taste compared to that, more as a comparison of how close was I to the mark.
Yeah, you see, I think from the thing with me, right, is that when I first started brewing, yeah, I had a fondness for craft beer.
Yep.
I mean, if you're going to be brewing beer, you're going to have a fondness for craft beer, right?
Yep.
But even when I started out and I didn't really know what I was doing, I would sort of recognize that these beers are not even in the same league as craft beer, right?
Yeah.
But they are a heck of a lot better than the budget beers that you can buy even from the bottle shop, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to get results with home brewing that are better than, you know, your basically non-craft beers.
Yep, your mainstream beers, yeah.
Yeah, but then I think once I started to get better at it and get to the point where I wasn't necessarily just blindly doing things, but referring to my notes and following processes that I had developed and, you know, coming to gain an appreciation for what grains I liked, what hops I like, what yeasts I like, what sugars, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, really refining it rather than just chucking things in a fermenter, stirring it up and leaving it 2 weeks and then carbonating it and seeing what happens, right?
Yeah.
Once I started to get to that stage, I wasn't comparing them with those mainstream beers anymore. I was comparing them with the craft beers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think you have sufficiently shamed me for not getting on top of getting my brews done.
I think you missed the boat from all accounts.
No, I could still do it. I can still do the. It could still happen.
I don't know. The temperature is warming up. See,
yeah,
that's one of the things I am with one of the brews I've got at the moment. I think it was the stout. I stuck that in the fridge to bring the temperature down a bit, and I think I brought it down too much and stalled the fermenter.
Right.
So it's just a little bit sweeter than it should be, but it's still drinkable.
Yeah.
A bit sweeter, lower alcohol content, but it's still good.
Yeah. But we'll see.
So next time we record, Matt, it's going to be closer to Christmas. You're going to have, hopefully, you're going to have resolved the technical debt built into your kegerator.
Yeah, that's right. The brew debt.
The brew debt.
Yeah.
Before it becomes an insurmountable problem.
Yeah.
And you have to go to the bottle shop and spend actual money buying beer.
Oh, I've already got backup beers. I've still got those two cases of stout.
So you prepaid your tech debt. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah. I guess that counts as savings.
If we want to carry the analogy that way, yeah. So I guess on that, Matt, that's it for this week's episode of Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
It's just too fucking hot. It's a million degrees. It's hotter than Satan's sweaty ball sack. And the reason that I can wait for you to stop laughing.
That's fine. I haven't heard that one.
I don't know if I've said it before either.